Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Get expert advice from your friendly healthcare team at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Good morning, you're very welcome to the show. So look, I presume the Taoiseach is sitting at home this morning agonising over what he should do when he goes to the White House on Wednesday. So my advice to him now, if he's listening, would be to get the papers, because there's loads of advice in there. Everyone has advice. And indeed, we have a panel here, and I suspect some of them might have advice as well. So the Sunday Independent is leading with revealed how Martin will try to keep Trump on side in Oval Office meeting. So they'll be pitching that Ireland is open for business. I think wasn't that an Enda Kenny line originally? Or the best little country in the world to do business was that Enda's line. Senior government source says the economic relationships will be a key focus as, quotes, Ireland understands Trump is a businessman. Now, it goes on to say that as well as giving him Shamrock, they'll present him with a special gift. We don't know what that is, right? Sources said they are prepared to discuss how they can further help his business interests at Trump International Golf Links and Hotel Doonbeg in County Clare. A source close to the US president said he will be keen to know how the government can remove barriers facing his business interests in Ireland. And they go on to talk about he has spoken publicly about issues he has with planning permission. Are we honestly going to go over to the president of America and offer a kind of grift to him? Like, I'd be very surprised. Look, I don't know the realities of how these things work, but crikey. Certainly, imagine with any other president of America, you're thinking we'll go over and see, can we help him out with a bit of planning permission or whatever. The Business Post, Ryanair and Kerry to be Taoiseach's Trump cards. So the president to focus on Ireland's trade surplus with US in Oval Office showdown, they're calling it. People are expecting like MMA at this stage now, but you'd wonder. The Sunday Times, tariffs will hurt us all. McGrath warns Trump, so that's Michael McGrath. Has warned President Trump that the EU will respond swiftly and firmly if the US acts on his threat of a trade war. And you can relax, everybody. He didn't say this to his face. He said it to the Sunday Times. The Irish Mail on Sunday is leading with a story about the National Ambulance Service and the secret recordings that they seem to have obtained from a whistleblower. And the Mirror is leading with top Irish jockey Sam Ewing revealing his devastation over the very sad death of his fellow jockey Michael O'Sullivan, saying his death is heartbreaking for everybody, and indeed it is. Our panel this morning, there is one more story I neglected to tell you there, and it's the off-lead in the Sunday Times and the Sunday Independent, and you will have heard it on the news there. That story, Sinn Féin TD Gúl questioned by Gardaí, is the off-lead in the Sunday Independent and similar on the Sunday Times. And that story is about the Sinn Féin TD for Cork North Central, Thomas Gould, who was arrested by appointment on Friday over financial issues at a company he previously worked with. He says he utterly rejects the allegations against him. He's having ongoing treatment for bowel cancer at the moment too, he says, and he considers this to be a serious attack on his reputation. Sinn Féin leader Lou MacDonald confirmed yesterday that the party was made aware of the complaint in early February, and she also said that Kenneth Collins, a Sinn Féin councillor in Cork who worked for the same company, this is according to the Sunday Indo story, was also questioned by Gardaí as part of the investigation in January. Okay, now, sorry. My panel this morning, Michael Kelly is a public affairs director at development NGO Aid to the Church in Need, and he is a former editor of the Irish Catholic newspaper. Dr. Emma Howard is an economist at TU Dublin. Bobby McDonough is former Irish ambassador to the UK and EU, and Alison O'Connor is a columnist with the Sunday Times. Good morning, everybody.
Morning, Brendan.
Dr. Emma Howard, I believe we have caught you on a very sad day for you after yesterday's match.
I think the back page on the Mail on Sunday summed it up for me, Les Miserables. Yeah, big rugby fan, was really disappointed, I think, with the magnitude of the scoreline. It kind of flattered us at the end there. But I do think, look, we were up against it. The news that James Lowe was injured in the warm-up didn't help matters, and we already were missing Mac Hansen and Tadhg Furlong and Gary Ringrose through suspension. So, you know, missing players of that calibre, and we've got a young kind of transitional period for the Irish rugby team. So as
a transitional coach and manager, people
exactly.
have been pointing
yeah,
out as well.
So you know what? It's Peter O'Reilly had a piece in the Sunday Times where he said, you know, at least there's no accusations of us peaking at the wrong time. So I would take lots of Six Nations losses if we could get past a World Cup quarterfinal. So maybe we're in a building phase to that.
Yeah, Bobby, you were at the match, were you?
Yeah, I was. I mean, I think the first thing you have to say is the French were brilliant. But on the Irish side, the two yellow cards worked against us, and the failure to translate absolute superiority in the first 20 minutes into points.
Yeah, I mean, they looked as if they were going to slaughter France.
And also the fact that the French fans were making more noise than the Irish fans. I mean, 15 minutes before the game, the French were singing La Marseillaise and so on. So that's a perennial problem at the Aviva, but I think that does make a difference to our team.
Yeah, it almost felt like a home match for the French at times, didn't it? And apparently everyone is saying that wherever they were in Dublin yesterday, French bonhomie singing and joie de vivre and everything seemed to be dominating the situation. But very disappointing.
Very disappointing, but that's sport, I suppose. You know, you can't celebrate your triumphs if you don't accept your defeats.
Yeah, yeah. The fact that DuPont was gone very early on as well might have given us some sense of hope, but even without the greatest player in the world. Yeah. Okay. So we'll move on to the next big clash. And I suppose I was going to say we hope it won't be a damn squib and a disappointment like yesterday, but in a way, I suppose we're looking for a damn squib. Alison, we'll start with Bertie Ahern in the Sunday Independent. He's telling Micheál Martin what to do.
Yeah, and I suppose you'd start by saying that it is wall to wall in today's papers. Micheál Martin's visit to Washington and his meeting with Donald Trump, and that phrase "he could wallpaper his bathroom" is literally true in this instance, given the volume of it. And there is a good piece, Niamh Horan in the Sunday Independent, where Bertie, who I think would have been, I think that we're actually lucky that Micheál Martin is Taoiseach at this time for this visit. I think he is our most competent and well-placed politician to do this. Having said, because I think he's experienced, excuse me, he's mature. I think he's been around the block enough times that he, as I'm enumerating all of their listing all of this, I'm also thinking, but, because it's Trump. So you can only
told how cranky he was there.
I think over this Dáil speaking row. But I think if we're putting our best foot forward, we are very well placed to put that forward with Micheál Martin. And he's leaving today, actually. So he's possibly reading the papers on the plane. Interestingly, he's going to Texas first, a Republican state where there is a very conservative governor, Governor Abbott. So in a way, you could say that's a good dry run before he heads up to Washington. And I guess if we, and I'm writing about this myself this morning in the Sunday Times, coming out of there with something, with a visit that has been non-controversial, is the very best we can hope for. I really haven't found any opinion amongst the papers, maybe I missed it, where anyone was advocating put it up to Trump. There was an element of that in the Dáil during the week, where Mary Lou MacDonald and that was kind of saying about Ukraine and Gaza. I don't think there's anything to be gained by that. Do we want to come out of there with our dignity? Of course we do. He says he's going to raise those things, but there are ways to do that. One thing that does interest me, and I really have sympathy for my colleagues who are going, the political correspondents, because you're thinking. And I was actually speaking to one of them on Friday about this, and I was kind of slagging, you have the economy of a nation on your shoulders. But I was thinking afterwards, it's really not funny. If there's an opportunity for the Irish media to ask questions, do you dive in asking questions about trade surpluses or, you know, about 25%?
I was reminded somewhere yesterday about, I think it was Senan Maloney.
Yeah.
At the time when Enda Kenny was there, asked a question. Enda Kenny was visiting Trump. It was that time that Enda Kenny went on and made that speech about immigration. Asked a question, I think, and I think he must have asked it in front of Trump and said, to Enda Kenny, you said this time last year that his speech was, that the way he talked was racist and something else. How do you feel about that now?
Yeah.
And Trump apparently looked dryly at Enda Kenny and said, is he one of yours?
and they moved on then.
Yeah, and I'd forgotten about that actually. Yeah. So I mean, I've been thinking about this the last couple of days.
Yeah.
That if I were part,
well, yeah, what would
I,
you do?
You know what?
What would you do?
I don't know. I mean, obviously, I would speak to my news editor or my editor, and you want a free and fair press. But you also, we are living in such unprecedented times. And I suppose I would think that if the journalists don't ask that question, I don't think it would be at all fair to accuse them of shirking out of it. I think that we are living in extraordinary times, and trying to, what is the benefit for anyone in trying to poke the bear when there could be a nuclear explosion?
Yeah. Yeah, and I think any journalist that did decide to do it to make a name for themselves, I imagine they'd get a lot of hate online and whatever else.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I mean, that's what, you know, that's the thing. I was reading a piece in the New York Times during the week where they were saying nobody, let alone Irish journalists, but over there, journalists trying to get people to comment on Trump, you know, the normal sort of opposition politicians, academics, experts. Nobody, and a large part of it is that the hate that's going to be piled down.
So before I move on to the others, what is Bertie saying?
Yes, indeed. My apologies. We'll get back to that. Bertie is saying, and I mean, we have to bear in mind the extraordinary job that Bertie Ahern did in the North and what seemed like an utterly impossible situation and the Good Friday Agreement and that. He said, do what I did in the North and just stare at the ceiling. So, I mean, I do think that there's an element of, there's an element of people saying that Micheál Martin, you know, in this case, stare at the ceiling, you know, touch his knee, all that sort of thing. And Bertie is also saying that Micheál knows his stuff backwards. He's well able to articulate his. And he makes an important point that the Taoiseach's people have also been making. They're saying this is about St. Patrick's Day, Irish-American relations. It's not about Ukraine. It's not about Putin. But I suppose isn't that in an ideal world?
Yeah,
that's where things get out of hand.
Okay, Michael Kelly, you picked Leo Varadkar is kind of offering some advice in the Sunday Times.
Yeah, I mean, look, post-election, Micheál Martin has his kitchen cabinet well selected. But, I mean, if he was looking for advisors, he's not short of them in the papers today. Everyone is offering advice and everyone seems to be offering this cautious type of optimism, you know, go in there, be proud of yourself, but proceed with absolute caution. I mean, and that's something that Mr. Varadkar is saying. He's making the point that Trump is clever, but he's not so well informed. And I think that is a widely held view, that Trump's not really a detailed person, that he's someone that looks at the big picture. And I think the mood music with which the Taoiseach is going in with is positive. I mean, when the president... Well, I think when the president was signing the decree the other evening, among the many hundreds of decrees he seems to sign every day declaring it Irish-American Heritage Month, he said the Irish are great people. So I think President Trump probably does have that instinctive warmth towards Ireland that you find in a lot of Americans.
I'm just going to say no. I think people might have got a slightly wrong impression about that because weirdly I saw it happening because sometimes I turn on Trump and I can't turn him off until something else forces itself in and makes me move. So He's being handed these decrees, yeah. Right? This decree has been signed by every president since George H.W. Bush in 1991, right? This is a standard thing. I don't think Trump wrote it or read it or anything else. He's handed it, and he's handed it by a flunky who... And the previous one was about women, and he's going, yeah, we love women. Women are great, and I've got great women here, and he holds it up, Donald, we love you women, right? And then he gets the one about the Irish. He did seem to kind of pause and smirk to himself for a second, and then he said, the Irish, yeah, we love the Irish. He very quickly then moved on to Irish Americans. Irish Americans voted for me in great numbers, that's why I like them.
Yeah.
Just on watching it, and you know when you see the detail and the texture of something, I wouldn't have said that he was necessarily being hugely positive about the Irish on it.
Irish Americans are not the bloc they once were as well. I mean, a generation ago, we could have thought of Irish Americans as really solidly Democratic supporters. I mean, I don't know the breakdown, but Trump is certainly correct that a portion of what used to be that one Irish American bloc is now solidly at home in the Republican
Democrat.
Party and supportive of him. I mean, a lot of the emphasis in the papers today is really saying that, you know, look, if we come away from this White House meeting and there's really no news, then that's a good day for Ireland and that's a good day for the Taoiseach. And really everyone is saying, I mean, don't be afraid to kind of ham up the paddywhackery. Don't be afraid, you know, to go full tilt Irish. But on the serious side of things, also try to get across to President Trump that this can be a win-win situation. I mean, it doesn't have to be the situation where the president sees every country that he has an interaction with as somehow ripping off America or screwing America, to use his own word.
Like he doesn't see win-wins, does he? He's it's a zero-sum game. And if you're winning, I'm losing. And if you're losing, I'm winning. So, Bobby, with your vast experience of these things, you have picked Shane Coleman, 10 things Micheál Martin needs to do when meeting Donald Trump, in the Business Post.
Yes, I think it's a very balanced piece by Shane Coleman. I mean, he makes the point that we can be reasonably optimistic that the meeting will go well, but it could also go horribly wrong. And I think unpredictability is the adjective that most strikes me about it. So I think the Taoiseach will go into it very positively. He'll talk about the economic trade relationship with the US. He'll talk about possibly inviting him to the Ryder Cup, maybe something about Doon Beg.
But hang on, is it that stuff in the Sunday Independent about the things they can do to further help his business in Doon Beg? Is that okay?
I don't think it's a big deal. I mean, obviously, the government aren't going to do anything that isn't within the law. But if they can make positive sounds about fixing potholes near Doon Beg, I don't see a problem with that. But I think it could also go wrong because we saw what happened with Zelensky. I don't expect that will happen, but there could be negative comments about one thing or another. And I think if it becomes more serious in public, when the media are there, the Taoiseach has to take a middle course, which is not to concede on principles and values of importance to us, but not to go in all guns blazing for confrontation.
Okay, so where's the line? Like, does he fact check, for example, if it turns into that rolling press conference chat thing that it turned into with Zelensky and Trump is saying things? Does Micheál Martin need to correct?
I think, honestly, as Alison said, you know, the Taoiseach is very well positioned to handle this very well. And the truth is that he can handle it better than any of us can advise him to do. But I think in those circumstances, he should probably try and kick any discussion into the more private session afterwards.
So stare at the ceiling, let some things go even if they're not factually.
It depends on how serious they are. He could calmly recall what our position is on issues of principle and then saying, hopefully we can get into more detail in our private session. But I think personality counts for a lot, and he has seen Macron and he has seen Starmer, and each of those played to their own personalities. I mean, Macron was confident, touchy-feely. Starmer was more reserved, serious, diffident. And they both combined flattery with firmness. And very importantly, they conveyed a vague overall sense of agreement with Trump's objectives. In other words, peace in Ukraine and peace in Gaza. But pointing out that certain things actually have to be implemented to achieve those, which Trump doesn't seem to have any notion of.
So maybe they pointed them out without taking him on directly, didn't they? They pointed them out when they were speaking themselves, would kind of put in a different form of language to what he had just said. But so they weren't selling out completely.
Exactly.
Interesting what you say about personality, because I suppose we kind of, in a way, we've moved on from the great man theory of history and everything. But you look at the last couple of weeks, and, you know, we all tend to think that, I don't know, there are adults in charge in international politics, adults in charge of the world. Is this as much about people's temperament as anything else? So that's like Starmer, substantially what he went over there was write a letter from the king and all that, but it wasn't that different to what anyone else is going there with. But just that it's about the kind of temperament he has and how he deals with Trump's temperament. Macron has a different temperament. Zelensky, maybe slightly intemperate in it. Like, does it come down to just the personality of one man? Like,
I think relationships have always counted. Relationships have always counted at the top in politics. Unfortunately, we haven't left behind us the great man theory of history, because we now have Trump and Putin, two strong men who believe in force rather than respect. But I think what Starmer and Macron tried to do, in addition to dealing with the specifics of their discussion, was to establish a relationship with Trump. And I think that's something that Micheál Martin will have to try to do, despite all the sort of appalling things that Trump says, including on Gaza. So I think the Taoiseach's strengths are that he is emotionally intelligent, he's courteous. Even his critics would say that he's statesmanlike. So he will have to, because of the
calm as well, generally.
I think so, cool,
presumably being calm and cool is a superpower in these situations, isn't it?
I think he will
just stay calm.
And I think we can be proud of many of our politicians, including Micheál Martin. I think in this case, he'll handle it extremely well.
He's getting a great preview of his match anyway. We'll see what the reviews are like afterwards. Emma, I want to ask you a bit about the more details of tariffy stuff that's in the paper. But first, just on this.
I think there's a couple of additional layers of complication because it's not just one volatile personality he has to deal with. So that piece with Bertie Ahern in the Sunday Independent, Bertie says in all his time he could never recall a Secretary of State or a Vice President speaking at any of the meetings.
Yes.
And we saw in that meeting with Zelensky, it was Vance who was the aggressor in a lot of those interactions. So this time around, what's quite different with Trump is he's surrounded himself by people like Vance, like Howard Lutnick, like Marco Rubio, where they're also, you know, picking fights. So we saw the spat with the Taoiseach and or the Taoiseach rather, you know, as to whether the deficit with Ireland was raised in the phone call between Simon Harris and Marco Rubio recently. So we've got those other personalities there that are quite combative and difficult to deal with. The other point, back to what Alison said about the Irish media and, you know, what they might do, because yes, there'll be opportunities to be, you know, to have these difficult conversations maybe behind closed doors. But what we're seeing now is that Trump is prolonging the media meetings, right? So more of the business is being done in the public, but also he's allowing the non-traditional media into the Oval Office. So you've got the right-wing media coming in, and, you know, that question about Zelensky, why didn't he wear a suit to the White House? That was not from a traditional media journalist. So while the Irish media might think carefully about what questions they ask, you can bet that some of the more difficult questions are going to come from those right-wing media journalists.
Alison, you pick Shane Ross as well. There'll be no dust up in the Oval Office on Micheál's beat.
Yeah, Shane, I suppose, is very much reflecting what he knows of Micheál Martin from his own time in politics. He's making the point that Trump would certainly not appreciate a lecture from a relatively unimportant but apparently ungrateful guest. And he says a dull draw would be a big win. And I think that does encapsulate what we should be seeking out of this.
As Emma points out, there are those other unknown unknowns, which I'd forgotten about there for a second. I don't think poor Marco Rubio is as enthusiastic an attack dog as the other two, judging by the Zelensky day.
Yeah.
But definitely,
Vance, it was,
and then Lutnick is doing it from a distance as well. But Vance and the conservative media in that room, someone could easily derail everything very quickly, couldn't they?
Yeah, I mean, this is the point in that in lots of ways we're on a total fool's errand here.
Yeah.
You know, we could be talking about it, you know, from now until then, and you just can't predict it. And that even if it goes well, that doesn't stand for anything either.
Yeah.
Like nobody, none of us have ever been in this situation before. And I find myself personally reading stuff, listening to podcasts, constantly seeking someone who maybe has the answer or can shed light on it or give me comfort, and it's just not there. And then you find yourself having these daft thoughts like, God, maybe if the stock exchange crashed, that would sort him out. And then you realise what...
And then it did.
Then,
and,
yeah, then it, no, but it hasn't quite yet. But you find yourself thinking, Jesus, I can't believe, you know, this would affect so many. So, I mean, there's kind of absolutely no accounting for where we're at right now. And you just have to, I don't know, do things like take great joy in the fact that in Dublin, anyway, this morning, the sun is shining.
Could I just add something to Emma's point, where she rightly points out that, you know, J.D. Vance could intervene and upset the apple cart completely. But that's a reminder that there are differences of view within the US administration. And Brendan, you mentioned Marco Rubio as well. So, you know, it's not entirely without hope that the Taoiseach can, as a small voice, exercise some influence, because there are ongoing debates, including about tariffs. There are Republican senators who haven't yet developed a backbone, but who don't approve of Putin. And there's, of course, Trump's own unpredictability. He contradicts himself from one day to the next.
There's the Democratic Party who are basically doing nothing.
Voices who
are kind of disgracefully, you could say, sitting back. I think
there's a lot of advice to them to play dead for now and let it collapse under the weight of its own contradictions.
But what about even former presidents? Are they, you know, yeah. there is it's normal that they wouldn't speak out, but that is given that we're in such abnormal times, should that change?
I think Vance will set the tone because, I mean, isn't he meeting Vance for breakfast in the morning?
Yeah.
And we know that Vance does take an interest in Irish affairs. We know that he wrote to the Irish ambassador in Washington previously about our now parked hate crime legislation. Mm. He was extremely concerned around that in terms of free speech. So I think a lot of it will depend on whether Vance decides to go into attack dog mode on this or whether he's in a kind of conciliatory mood. Marco Rubio seems to be increasingly...
And Leo Varadkar developed a great friend. Leo and Matt developed a great friendship with Mike Pence and the wife.
Absolutely, when everyone was queuing that up to be an event that was going to be very, very confrontational.
And Vance is a Catholic as well. So
Vance is Catholic, a relatively recent convert to Catholicism, which, you know, adds an interesting dimension to it.
But sadly,
I think that will... I think that will set the tone for what the meeting's going to be. So in some ways, J.D. Vance is the key player here.
But we also know within all of that dynamic is that Trump doesn't like to be upstaged. And that was one of the things that struck me with the Zelensky meeting, was that at times, even though he was appeared to be doing it in defence of Trump and what Trump's beliefs and what he wanted, that you could easily see a time where Trump would decide, you know, this guy's getting too big for his boots.
Yeah. He's already said about Marco Rubio, he said he got 100%, 100 out of 100 votes to be in cabinet.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if I like that or not.
Yeah. And so also, I think Trump has also sided with in a cabinet meeting about Musk and the Doge stuff.
Against Rubio.
Against Musk.
Well,
you know,
there's been
in
a slight,
that he actually.
There's a slight muzzling of Musk.
You know, so there's those kind of. I don't know whether you're going. The other thing that interests me in the papers that I think if we didn't have this White House meeting, is all about neutrality.
We'll come to that. I want to ask Emma first about tariffs, because Emma, you've picked a few pieces here, and you might just maybe roll them into a general little mini masterclass for us now. So Michael McGrath warning Trump tariffs will hurt us all. Give us the ladybird first. Tariffs hurt everyone, yes?
Tariffs hurt everybody, including the country that's imposing them. And so we know that the first round of tariffs Trump introduced in the US reduced job growth in the US and increased prices for consumers. So although he said tariff was his favourite word and he describes it as a tax on foreigners, what it really does is it rises US inflation and makes things more expensive for US consumers, but also for US firms who are often buying a lot of those imports into the US as intermediate, as inputs into their own production process.
Okay.
So
this now is like you're not going to know the answer. But anyway, like there were four different tariff regimes, I think, announced last week. Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, he pulled back on cars, then pulled back on everything else.
And
then
so
suddenly on Friday, he comes in and 250% tariffs on milk products from Canada. Are these tariffs going to happen, do you believe?
Totally,
or is this
unpredictable. It's very, very hard to know what he's going to do. So what he has said is that he is going to put reciprocal tariffs, was his first suggestion, on countries. So he said, you know, if you're charging a tariff on US imports, we'll do exactly the same level of tariff on imports into the US.
And he is mistakenly viewing VAT as a tariff.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So VAT, which is a real source of revenue for European countries, and so for Ireland included, he's saying that's he's going to consider that akin to a tariff. Now, what that means is that he's looking at various times he's talked about a flat 25% tariff rate on EU imports into the US. But if we look at what he's done so far, for example, with Mexico and Canada, he announced a 25% tariff. First, it was delayed because there were some negotiations. Then it was implemented. Then he rode back on approximately half of the goods that were covered by that tariff. He said that any under the North America free trade agreement would be exempt. So he's flip-flopping all over the place.
OK, so do you think it's a tactic then rather than a serious idea?
I think it's a possibility. And okay. I suppose there's
and
a
if
couple...
if tariffs at that level happen between the EU and America...
Are we going to go into a recession? A huge impact on the Irish economy. So if you
recession,
look at...
potentially?
Quite possibly, yeah. I mean, well, I suppose there's a couple of things, right? Ireland, we're a small open economy. So we're really sensitive to global macroeconomic shocks. And if you look at what's happening, so we said, you know, the US markets are falling... We're seeing rising inflation in the US from its economic policies. If the US goes into a recession, biggest economy in the world, that's going to have a negative impact on us.
Okay.
We're quite reliant on foreign multinationals here, both for employment, but also predominantly for our government revenue. So, you know, most of our more than a quarter of our government revenue comes from corporation tax now. And a lot of that is coming from these foreign multinationals. So okay. Declining activity there impacts our public purse. But the other thing, I suppose, is that we're at risk. He's got a lot of different ideas on tariffs, but we're also at risk from his targeted tariffs, which he is quite likely, I think, to introduce some that he keeps. And one he's talked about is on pharma. So if you look at our exports, pharma is a big sector here. And so even those target more targeted rather than universal okay. tariffs.
And listen,
will have a big
is it irrelevant at this stage that the WTO does not allow tariffs on pharma? We've gone well beyond.
We've gone beyond, you know, one of and something that's not talked about a lot, which I thought was really concerning, is like in his, one of his first directives that he signed in his first day in office, is he signed a directive saying, so the new OECD global minimum corporation tax rate that everyone agreed to of 15%, which is why our corporation tax rate went up to that level. He signed a directive saying the US don't have to adhere to that anymore.
Okay.
So it's
before,
very clear.
Before we finish on this, and yeah. I don't want to lose people who are too much economics, but you think that there's a piece by Daniel Murray in the Business Post about phantom exports coming back to haunt Taoiseach. Will you explain to people just briefly and simply what phantom exports are?
So phantom exports are exports of goods that probably were never actually in Ireland in the first place. So because we have a lot of foreign multinational activity here, a lot of companies that are based here, they initially would have located here partly to avail of our lower corporation tax rate of 12.5%, but they would have outsourced some of the production of their goods. So if you think of Apple, for example, you know, most of the parts of the iPhones, maybe the iPhones in general, would be made outside by contracted companies in other countries, but they would be logged as exports from Ireland, for example.
But they never actually passed
through.
It, there's a magic wand waved. And
that's how Luknic described it, yeah.
Okay,
and
so we could be in trouble there.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the level of those, like it's a big percentage of our exports to the US are these. And this is one of the reasons why economists, the Irish Fiscal Advisory Council, everyone has been warning the government for a number of years about their reliance on this these corporation taxes from these foreign okay. multinationals, because they could very easily end up just shifting that tax that they're paying to another country and those goods no longer
okay.
get
Bob, just one
in
second,
Ireland.
Thanks, Emma. I want to ask Michael about... Michael, I think you're in touch with people in America all the time, aren't you? And the kind of people that maybe we don't hear from so much, kind of Trump voters and stuff. How are they feeling about all this? Is this what they voted for?
Yeah, I spent some time as a teenager living in southwest Louisiana, just right on the border there with Texas. So probably spent a lot of time and made a lot of friendships with the kind of Americans that, you know, not many Irish people know. We tend, when we're there, to move in kind of bubbles on the coast. A lot of these people registered Democrats, but voted for Trump, enthusiastic for Trump for all kinds of various reasons. Part of it is, you know, white working class people feeling rightly or wrongly that they're left behind, feeling that they no longer have a stake in the Democratic Party. So post-election, they were extremely enthusiastic about Trump, loved a lot of the rhetoric. This is despite the fact that they would acknowledge the last time he was in office, he didn't really do anything for them. Speaking to them now, I'm kind of saying, you know, look, is this what you voted for? What's happening now in terms of all of this confusion about the tariffs, what that's going to do about inflation? And emphatically, it's not. But I think this says something about how broken the American political system is, that Trump is some kind of act of desperation for people. I mean, even though second time around the block, I mean, he achieved nothing for these people during his last 4 years in office, and yet faced with a career politician like Kamala Harris, faced with the full weight of the Democratic Party, faced with all all of those kind of Hollywood faced and with celebrity the endorsements. Faced with the status quo, they went for Trump again. And again, one of the things that that a number of people were saying to me on Friday when I was speaking to them is, you know, the whole Musk thing, they didn't expect Elon Musk to be at the heart of government. Many of these people that I'm talking about are government employees, yeah. They are federal employees, they have small administrative jobs on relatively modest salaries, and Elon Musk is speaking publicly now like somehow they're the problem, they're the people who are ripping off the American taxpayer.
Okay, yeah, Bobby, you wanted to come in.
Yeah, I mean, I think Trump supporters are gradually going to learn that their medical cover is removed, and that in the case of the tariffs in particular, as Emma said, it will damage everybody. So it will also begin to damage Trump supporters, and hopefully that will begin to have some impact on the level of support he has. The
other thing it can't. So impact on the level of support. There's no elections for two years.
No, indeed. But it's important
that
to see how
some Republicans might start standing up to him. Hopefully,
just ordinary people will realize the impact that he's having on their lives.
But put pressure maybe on their Republicans to grow a bit of a backbone.
Hopefully.
Yeah.
And the other important point is just to recall that the European Union acts as a whole on these trade issues, and we're very fortunate to have the entire weight of the single market behind us in whatever Trump tries to do. And I think in that context, it's important to remember that the Taoiseach in Washington is representing Europe as well as Ireland. Europe is part of what we are. And one of the main arguments we have for American investment in Ireland is that it's a bridge into Europe. And the last point I'd make briefly...
On that one. No, I haven't heard people mention this, so I'm probably wrong. But kind of real talk here, right? Is Europe going to be going out to bat for our kind of, shall we call it, unique situation vis-a-vis our trade with America? Like, the rest of Europe aren't that happy with our taxation regime and how we've done from it, are they?
Look, we saw what Europe did for Ireland on Brexit.
Exactly. The whole of Europe stood absolutely behind us. Are they really going to go again now to protect a tax regime that they strongly disapprove of, a lot of them, and that they're jealous of?
No, Ireland has moved towards the OECD tax regime. They're not going to look at the issues with the US and say, okay, we'll forget about France, we'll forget about Denmark, we're going to protect Ireland. But we have huge collective interests, and in that context,
I just wonder if
a one-size-fits-all
solution for Europe might still leave us exposed, would you not think?
No member state is going to get everything that it wants in the trade negotiations, but Ireland will get quite a lot. But I think it's also important in terms of, you mentioned the WTO, to recall that China said it would take the tariff dispute to the WTO. That might not achieve anything, but it's a reminder that we are now in some senses closer to China than we are to the United States in terms of international
Because China likes the world order as it is, doesn't it? It likes trade as it is and everything, which is, it is. It's all head spinning, isn't it? Okay, Michael Kelly, Dr. Emma Howard, Bobby McDonough and Alison O'Connor staying with us. And by the way, just before we take a break, when I mentioned at the start of the show there the arrest by appointment of Sinn Féin TD Thomas Gould and Sinn Féin councillor Kenneth Collins, I did neglect to say that, like Thomas Gould, councillor Kenneth Collins also denies any wrongdoing. Welcome back. Michael Kelly, Dr. Emma Howard, Bobby McDonough and Alison O'Connor are still with us, and it's never too early to start a presidential election, Alison, and we have some runners and riders out today.
Yeah, this is starting to hot up, isn't it? And actually, I think there's just so much else going on at the moment that I'm surprised in a way that there isn't. The only person we have declared so far is Peter Casey, who ran previously. So the Sunday Independent, Senna Maloney has a piece with Sean Kelly, and Sean is basically really putting himself out there, but being careful enough with it, in that he set out a stall about how experienced he is, all of that, but he's saying he'd have to talk to his family to consider it very carefully. So I suppose that's the way you hold on to your dignity if somebody. Mm-hmm.
Well, he is doing this. He is, of course, a former Fine Gael MEP.
Yes,
but he's also a former president of the GAA.
But
is he not putting it out there as so many people have come to him and encouraged him to run that it would be disrespectful of him not to consider it?
He pulled that paragraph from that generic political handbook of when there are big jobs coming up, of how so many people approached me. I just could. The last person I think we heard say that was Seán Ó Fíorchaoil about the job of Ciarán Cúrla, although he has
It would have been remiss of Seán Ó Fíorchaoil not to run that time.
And it now would be remiss of Sean Kelly.
So you and have not worth mentioning. How many votes did he get?
I mean, he did phenomenally well. He secured almost 123,000 first preference votes in Ireland South. So that really is a very, but there is huge competition within the Fine Gael party. You have Sean, you have Mairead McGuinness. There's talk of Frances Fitzgerald, although some talk now, you know, whether she's behind, she's saying that she's still in, but some talk behind the scenes that maybe no, she's actually not. So then you have the story in the Mail on Sunday by John Lee saying Barry Andrews, now Fianna Fáil's frontrunner for the Oras. So I was texting someone at Fianna Fáil this morning and asking them. So John also has that Cynthia Nuvaraku, possibly Barry Andrews and Bertie. So my correspondent said that Cynthia has notions of it, but has no chance. Bertie, no Bertie either, no go. And according to the person I was talking to, it was the first mention they'd heard of Barry. Barry Andrews. John is saying that he has the perfect sort of pedigree given how steeped in politics that he is. The other talk that's still going around is the possibility of a Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael agreed candidate. I don't ever see that happening. And we know that there's been talks with the more left-wing, you know, we're talking about possible
candidates. The opposition together, maybe,
Do you know what? I find that hard. Find that hard that they would reach agreement. There's, first of all, you have Sinn Féin could do it on their own. They have enough for, you know, they have 20 parliamentary party, enough members, you know, that they could nominate somebody. But I just think there are so many different angles to this. If you even consider, like, Labour and the Soc Dems are so suspicious of each other. Labour's suspicious of Sinn Féin. The Soc Dems aren't that. You know what I mean? Mm. To try and I was even thinking that if you were an agreed candidate, even, for instance, and somebody started asking you about what you thought of the Troubles and all, you know what I mean? There are so many different, you know,
that Labour might not want to be dragged into
that. It's hard. It's difficult to see that. It's difficult to see that.
Emma, are you excited about the ticket so far as outlined this morning?
Do you know what struck me about the ticket, especially with it being International Women's Day yesterday and our considerable underrepresentation of women in our extended Dáil, is that although, as Alison pointed out, Cynthia Nuvaraku is being touted as a potential candidate, a Fianna Fáil minister is quoted in that piece in the Mail on Sunday as saying that she's very impressive, but she'll have to serve her time. This one is for the old boys club. And in the same piece, they have Fine Gael.
Is that the phrase?
That's the phrase quoted that they say they sourced
an
from.
An unnamed minister.
Another unnamed Fine Gael minister is saying, and you know what's interesting is Simon Harris actually, I think, has three very good potential women candidates in Heather Humphreys has been floated, as well as Frances Fitzgerald and Mairead McGuinness. But Simon Harris apparently favours a celebrity or a sports star. And I think any of the talk about maybe a joint government candidate, the fact that Fine Gael haven't ever had a successful presidential candidate is probably, you know, one goal that they want to meet. So, yeah, I found it kind of frustrating.
Star, celebrity. Is it time, Bobby, to go for that kind of thing? Well, Tommy Tiernan has done well in a few opinion polls recently.
Well, I think it's appropriate with Cheltenham coming up. We should be talking about runners and riders. But personally, I'd prefer more focus on the type of president we want, on the profile. And this morning, reading those various articles,
it struck me, is it not that you know it when you see it? No?
Well, it struck me extremely briefly, four things. First of all, somebody who doesn't deploy an anti-migrant xenophobic dog whistle. Secondly, somebody who asserts the values of the Irish people without confusing the president's role with that of the government. Thirdly,
I won't ask you who you're talking about. Go on.
Somebody who's solidly pro-European in all dimensions. And fourthly, somebody with whom there's no risk that they would pay respect to those who inflicted violence on the people of this island for 30 years. If any candidate comes up meeting those four requirements, I'm for them.
Okay, and temperament.
Temperance
in the world we're in.
And I'd be delighted to see a woman, and we've had two fantastic female presidents. But those would be my four core requirements.
Okay, yeah, like it. Michael?
Yeah, look, I mean, I largely agree with Bobby. I think we need to think about the type of presidency we want, the type of person we want. We saw the transformation of the presidency in Mary Robinson, and then especially in Mary McAleese. I mean, there can't have been a men's shed or a parish hall in this country that Mary McAleese didn't go to. And that really brought the presidency very, very close to people, and I think made the president this kind of, you know, empathizer in chief, if you like. Very much so. And, you know, I mean, like, I remember I'm from Oma, and I remember in the immediate aftermath of the bombing, Mary McAleese coming to Oma, and just her warmth there and just hugging everyone. And it wasn't, you know, that she had anything special or specific to say, but she really represented the arms of the nation around people at that time. And I think we should be looking at that sort of character. I mean, Sean Kelly obviously has a huge kind of capital coming from the GAA background. I think the fact that he's been in Europe rather than being in the Oireachtas has also meant he hasn't been involved in a lot of these partisan fights. So he will attract, support from across the board. I mean, one thing that I'll be interested to see, because this is certainly whispered about, is what the current president of the GAA will do, Jarlath Burns. I mean, he's often been spoken about as a potential candidate. We know that in terms of gene pool, he would be close to Sinn Féin. I don't think he's a member of the party. I don't know, but certainly that's where he would lie gene pool wise. In that circumstance, would Sinn Féin stand aside if someone like Jarlath Burns wanted to go as a kind of independent candidate for the presidency? I just don't know. I mean, where would a candidate from Northern Ireland stand? Does that still matter in the way it mattered when Mary McAleese ran at the time, for example? And I think there are kind of unknowns to that, but what we do know, the kind of the All-Ireland dimension is an increasingly important dimension in our political discourse.
Yeah. God, isn't it so relaxing talking about something easy and of no consequences like that compared to the other stuff? So let's get back to things of consequence. Emma, Wayne O'Connor in the Sunday Independent has the IPAV report that they put out every now and again on house prices and sales and all that. Retirees now driving up house prices in scenic areas along the coastline.
Yes, this is what I would call anecdotal evidence as an economist. So, I mean, yeah, it's kind of based on talking to estate agents and people who are selling the houses.
But I think we do know, don't we, that houses by the sea since the pandemic
have gone up. Exactly. Now, why they've gone up is a question that can still be answered. But yeah, I mean, some counties, 60% increase in house prices since 2020. So we're definitely seeing this. And, you know, again, anecdotally, my husband's from a small village in West Cork, Castle Townsend, and most of that village now is holiday homes. And the prices are completely unaffordable for anybody who...
Castle Townsend was always viewed as an outpost of the English Empire.
Yes, indeed, Brendan. That's another story we don't have time to go into. there's an issue, I think, in Ireland, when we think about the housing crisis and the lack of supply of homes, right? We know we have to build huge number to try and address it. But it's also, how do we utilise the current housing stock that we have? Okay. And we have very low, so most of the wealth in Ireland is within housing. Most households' wealth is within their housing. And we have a big issue with not taxing it a lot. And in particular, where people have second homes, you know, people are entitled to buy a second home to, you know, live some of their time by the sea. But, you know, should we not be taxing them a lot more for that luxury, given that we're in a housing crisis?
Okay, and they will say, well, you know, our family inherited this home. It's the home place or something that we came from.
Yep,
and we keep it now. We share it among the family. We have the house, but we don't have a lot of money. And we can't pay punitive taxes on it.
Yeah, but you can sell it then. You know, so I guess the problem is, I think, at the moment that all of the incumbency get too many rights in when we think about, we're in a housing crisis.
Okay.
We've got thousands of children who are living in homeless accommodation. We've got many, many young people. We've got a locked out generation who don't see any realistic way to buy a house. And we're not going to be able to build the houses as quickly as we need them. So utilising that current stock. So,
okay,
you know,
so
disincentivising people from it. So, you know, we need to
get the boomers
for example,
their second homes. Alison, you're from down the road. We'll come back to the council.
The other piece as well.
Down around Bantry, would that be a phenomenon you see?
Yeah, more actually, more so than it used to be. And I have to hold my hand up and admit to having a small, very small, but a holiday house. But I don't disagree with what Emma is saying. But I'm also thinking that given we have such difficulty just with property tax for starters, in this country, it'd be difficult to see the government. But I mean, these are the kind of things we have to start doing. I mean, we've seen that the government has come back in, or the Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael have come back into government. They are trying to get momentum behind it, but you still are stuck with that feeling that the decisions that need to be made are not being made. There's that story, I think, that you mentioned in the Mail about...
Yeah, about, this is John Drennan, Shame of Local Councils, with enough empty houses for all 4,600 children without
a home. So an utterly extraordinary thing that has been continuing, whether it be councils or whether it be semi-states, even government departments owning land, that the government has been saying to the cabinet for the last couple of years, do something about this, identify where these sites are, where we can build, what we can do. And that just hasn't happened, which is an utter... So it's like you have one arm of the government accepting that there's a crisis, the entire populace up in arms about it, people unable to buy houses. I mean, I saw a house near me yesterday. Somebody had put it up on social media that's gone for sale for, it was a two-bedroom house, gone up to nearly 600,000. And I, honest to God, I nearly dropped the newspaper and I thought, this is... So it's still, we're still in absolute crazy land. So yes, they have to start breaking things.
Part of the issue there with these council houses, it seems to take councils a very long time to turn them around between tenants, do they? And a lot of money as well. They seem to completely refurbish them almost.
Yeah, it seems like it. So it's nearly 4,000 homes that were left empty last year. But on top of that, there's
also... council-owned homes.
Council-owned homes. On top of that, there's the 22% increase in 2023 of the derelict homes. And what I found shocking in that piece as well is that, you know, we have a level of fine that's too low on those properties because, you know, everything, all the house prices, all the value of land is going up so quickly. Land is a huge...
How much is the tax at the moment?
So I'm not entirely sure exactly what the tax is, but I can tell you that the total amount of fines that are unpaid now, so it's a fine rather than a tax that comes in on the dereliction if you allow it to go in, but the total amount of unpaid is over 20 million. So they're fining and then they're not following through. And what you have is really an incentive for people to hold onto the land, to hold onto the derelict properties because we see how much prices are going up. And they're not actually even having to pay the fines that are being imposed.
Okay, so bottom line, you're saying like, yes, we can talk about building 50, 60,000 houses a year, but let's
fix
at what's
this.
There.
Bottom line is we already spend a huge amount of public money on housing. We spend more than most of our European counterparts as a percentage of our economy. So this is one crisis, actually, that it's not spending more money on housing is not necessarily the answer. We need to look at the housing stock that we already have and utilise it
and
properly.
Get cuter about
but
it.
We also need to look at our planning and regulation system and make it easier and quicker. You know, we all see these appeals and the years and years and years that it takes to develop. The old Dundrum shopping centre is an example in point. Perfect location for housing. Yet again, there's been
local people have their issues.
They do have their issues, but again, that's down to the incumbents, Brendan, right? So local people don't want the value of their own housing being reduced or having to wait longer for buses. And, you know...
Yeah, I'm sure lots of people who objected had valid reasons, but I take your point.
Sure, but again, you know, those in their houses...
So the incumbents need to get a bit more empathic.
Yeah.
All right, Michael Kelly, Dr. Emma Howard, Bobby McDonough and Alison O'Connor staying with us. I'll take a quick break. Welcome back, Michael Kelly, Dr. Emma Hurd, Bobby McDonough, Alison O'Connor still with us. Michael Kelly, we just have a quick minute to check in on the Pope. So we're getting very constant updates and in great detail a lot of the time about the Pope's health.
Yeah, last night probably was the most optimistic ever. They said that a gradual slight improvement had been noticed. I mean, you have to set that aside, the fact two nights earlier he issued an audio recording of his voice in which he sounded very, very weak. He sounded very, very breathless. I mean, he is 88 years of age, not in very good health. So all of these things at that age are relative. I mean, anyone who's been dealing with an elderly relative would know that. But look...
And I don't remember, but is it normal to be getting this level of detail on the Pope when he's in hospital?
Oh, certainly, yeah. When John Paul II was in hospital, I mean, I remember I worked in Rome at the time and there used to be details, not only that he had his breakfast, but what exactly he had for breakfast in the morning. I mean, the Vatican are very, very keen on managing messaging around these things. And I mean, if you've read Italian newspapers as well, the Italian press love the detail of everything. So what type of biscotti he had for his breakfast is hugely important for the people in the local cafe to know.
Okay, okay. Because I think a lot of people are thinking, God, would they leave the poor man alone to be
sick?
Yeah,
I mean, look, yeah. It's clearly a grave situation. And for all of this to be played out in public, I mean, he's the Pope, of course, but he is a man after all.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you very much to my panel this morning, Michael Kelly, Dr. Emma Howard, Bobby McDonough and Alison O'Connor. And listen, after the news, right, I'll just tell you this because it's I think it's worth hanging around for. So Gary Lightbody from Snow Patrol has written an extraordinary book. It's really raw and it's so incredibly moving. And it's kind of about himself, but it's mainly about himself and his dad and their relationship and his dad's death and how he was in the aftermath of his dad's death. But it really is so good. So I'm looking forward to that. That'll be coming up after the news at 12 o'clock. So look, thanks to my panel. And just now at 12 noon, we'll go to the newsroom and Kate Egan.